How will you disrupt yourself?
On today's show,
self-help books which said you create what you want in this world first in your mind and then it happens in the world. I think I've experienced at least one or two such moments.
Welcome to the Disrupt Yourself podcast, a podcast where we discuss strategies and advice for how to climb the S-curve of learning in your professional and personal life, disrupting who you are now to slingshot into who you want to be. I'm your host, Whitney Johnson, and today our guest is Sumeet Shetty, a former Quiz Bowl champion and a software developer at SAP India, where he's also the founder of Literati, India's largest corporate book club, which is where I first met him. Sumeet's love of books is contagious. Books are, after all, a great source of inspiration and instruction as we disrupt ourselves. In this interview, I've also asked him to share with us an example of how to manage people at the top of their S-curve of learning. A delightful human being, Sumeet, welcome.
Whitney, thank you for having me on this podcast.
What I would like to do as a starting point for people to get to know you is for you to share with us three stories about you, three stories that are very formative that will tell our listeners who you are. What are those stories?
If I think about three stories that have had a huge formative influence on me, I would go back first to, I think it's about the year 1992. I'm in school. I have my summer vacations coming up and I get a present from my parents, and that's membership to a local library. There was this small little library in Bangalore, not too far away from where I stayed. It was called Sunny's Circulating Library, a very small little space crammed with books. And I remember going there with my father. He paid my membership fee and essentially he let me loose in that library. And what happened afterwards was that it was the beginning of a lifelong love affair with books. I remember the first book that I borrowed. And this was a book by a writer called Enid Blyton, someone whose work I still cherish and treasure today. The book that I borrowed was called Five on a Treasure Island. And it was a group of children known as the Famous Five, and they had all these adventures and they solved crimes. I was fascinated by that, and as I said earlier, it was the beginning of a lifelong love affair with books. So that's one big part of who I am, my love for books. And books for me, as Stephen King once said, they are a uniquely portable magic, and that's how they've been in my life. If I go now and talk about the second story that influenced my life in a major way. I was in school. This was 1994. And the Times of India, India's largest newspaper, came in with this program called Newspaper in Education. So essentially, you as a student would get the newspaper at school and somebody from the Times of India would come and do a workshop for you. And they would cover topics like books or music or cartoons or science. So once a month, somebody would come and do a workshop about a topic that was not on the official curriculum of the school. And that was fascinating as well. And I think a little later in 1994, the Times of India decided to host the first quiz for school children. And because I had this reputation for being a bit of a reader at school, my school nominated me to be on the quiz team. In fact, they didn't just nominate me. We had to go through an internal quiz to select the school's quiz team. I was the only student from the 7th grade who made it into the quiz team. My two other partners were from the 10th grade. So I go into this school quiz in Bangalore. We have some of the best schools from the city competing. It's the first quiz of my life, and my team goes on to win the quiz. So I remember getting off stage and being a little dazzled by the fact that we finished first. Remember, this is the first quiz of my life. And I also remember that as I got off stage, people were coming and congratulating the winning team. And they shook hands with the two 10th graders. And they didn't shake my hand. They pinched my cheeks because I was still wearing shorts. In my school, you got to wear trousers from the eighth grade. And here I was, a chubby little kid wearing trousers, and nobody thought that I might actually enjoy shaking hands with them. So I got my cheeks pinched. Right, so this was a huge adrenaline rush for me, because my prize for coming in first was an electric watch and a very interesting book published by the Times of India Group. It was essentially the first page of the newspaper over the last 50 or 100 years.
Mm.
So I still have that book, and I treasure it. So winning things, getting prizes, became a regular part of my life. And it was neo-Pavlovian in its effect on me. So I learned that if I wanted something in my life, I had to work hard towards it and earn it or win it. There's this very interesting incident that I often like to tell people about. I think it must have been about 1996. There was a company called MaxPage, and they decided to conduct their own quiz. And at that time, I had two objects on my wish list. I remember speaking with my father about getting me a Casio digital diary. And the second object of desire was a Sony Walkman. So my father was the kind of guy, if I spoke with him about getting new toys or clothes or objects of desire, he would negotiate with me. He would say, oh, your birthday isn't around the corner, or, you know, the end of the year is still quite far away. But if I asked for books, he always said yes. So long story short, I didn't get from him the digital diary or the Walkman. But we go into the MaxPage quiz. We get into the finals. And as one of the finalists, I received a gift hamper, which I brought back home. And I always liked to open my prizes once I got home, because I could share what I had won with my parents. And imagine my surprise when I open up this little box, as though the entire universe is conspiring to make my wishes come true. What comes out of the box first is a Casio digital diary. What comes out next is a Sony Walkman.
No.
It is the most incredible story, unless you have experienced it. And, you know, later on in my life, when I read self-help books which said you create what you want in this world, first in your mind, and then it happens in the world, I think I've experienced at least one or two such moments.
What a great story. Oh, fantastic.
If I had to pick one more moment in my life which was hugely influential, it would be a time in university. I had this close friend of mine who recommended that I read a comic strip called Calvin and Hobbes by Bill Watterson. And again, I was completely mesmerized by Calvin and Hobbes. And as I went deeper and deeper into Calvin and Hobbes and started appreciating the art behind the artwork, I also started exploring the life of Bill Watterson. And as I was doing this, I discovered a speech that he'd made at Kenyon College, I think in 1990. This was a commencement speech by Bill Watterson. And this speech is probably one of those documents. And I say document because I didn't hear the speech, of course. I read a transcript of it. It's been one of the most life-changing documents for me. Bill Watterson, his thoughts on life, on art, on the nature of work, on money. So many of those thoughts resonated with me. And a little earlier today, I went back and reread that speech. And I think it still resonates as strongly with me as it did so many years ago.
Mm. Would you share a passage from it that you really love?
So here's a section from Bill Watterson's commencement speech at Kenyon College in 1990. And I quote, "It's surprising how hard we'll work when the work is done just for ourselves. And with all due respect to John Stuart Mill, maybe utilitarianism is overrated. If I've learned one thing from being a cartoonist, it's how important playing is to creativity and happiness. My job is essentially to come up with 365 ideas a year. If you ever want to find out just how uninteresting you really are, get a job where the quality and frequency of your thoughts determine your livelihood. I found that the only way I can keep writing every day, year after year, is to let my mind wander into new territories. To do that, I've had to cultivate a kind of mental playfulness. We're not really taught how to recreate constructively. We need to do more than find diversions. We need to restore and expand ourselves. Our idea of relaxing is all too often to plop down in front of the television set and let its pandering idiocy liquefy our brains. Shutting off the thought process is not rejuvenating. The mind is like a car battery. It recharges by running. You may be surprised to find how quickly daily routine and the demands of just getting by absorb your waking hours. You may be surprised by matters of habit rather than thought and inquiry. You may be surprised to find how quickly you start to see your life in terms of other people's expectations rather than issues. You may be surprised to find out how quickly reading a good book sounds like a luxury. At school, new ideas are thrust at you every day. Out in the world, you'll have to find the inner motivation to reach for new ideas on your own. With any luck at all, you'll never need to take an idea and squeeze a punchline out of it. But as bright, creative people, you'll be called upon to generate ideas and solutions all your lives. Letting your mind play is the best way to solve problems.
I love that. All right, so Sumit, what about that spoke to you so deeply that it's become a lodestar for you?
I think it's Bill Watterson's meditation on the nature of work, the quote where he says, it's surprising how hard we'll work when the work is done just for ourselves. So throughout my life, I think most of the projects that I've picked up, both professional and personal, have been projects that have mattered to me. And I've always worked because the work has been meaningful. I haven't worked to impress anybody else. I haven't worked to make my boss happy. I worked because I found joy in the work itself. And most of the work that I've done was done for myself.
All right, Sumit, you've told us these fantastic stories. Can you now talk about how your love of books and your fascination with Quiz Bowl have influenced your career?
I think I had many advantages getting into the workplace because of my love for books and because of my love for quizzing. The first thing is that the love for books and quizzing had made me intellectually very curious. With many years of reading, I'd become a speed reader by default. So it allowed me, when I entered the workforce, to be able to digest a large amount of information in a short time, to be able to interpret it. And also, a lot of my experiences outside of the classroom at school, I was constantly at literary festivals, on stage at quizzes. It gave me the social skills that I needed to succeed in the workplace. So in my first month at work, I quickly became known for being the guy who called up employees at our global offices, asking them for help with a quick question or a suggestion. And I think it only happened because I had the confidence to pick up the phone, announce my name, and say, hey, I'm Sumit Shetty. I work in Bangalore, and I have a quick question. May I have a minute of your time? And having said that, I sometimes took much more than a minute of the other person's time. But I was always grateful for the help that I got from colleagues, a lot of them whom I'd never seen before. And that was also a big lesson for me in my life, to be helpful to whoever asked for it. So my journey in the world of books and quizzing made me curious, helped me to be creative, helped me to deal with ambiguity. So if you're in a quiz bowl and you're asked a question, very often it happens that you don't know the answer when you hear the question. But then the quizmaster usually tells you all clues to the answer are in the question. And then you take those little clues and you try to tease out little conclusions out of them. And there are many times when I've not known the answer to a question in a quiz when it was asked, but after a couple of minutes of thinking, my team and I had worked out the answer. And isn't that how the business world is like? It's full of problems. Nobody knows what's the right way to solve the problem. In fact, there isn't even a right way to solve the problem. So that intellectual curiosity and that ability to solve problems and to answer questions in a unique way, that comes from my love for books and from many years of cuisine.
So a couple of things that are coming to my mind as I'm hearing you say this. This idea is that the clues to the answer are in the question. And that really is a reminder of the importance of taking the time to figure out what the right question is to ask for us in general when we're trying to get the answers that we want, but also for you to say, when someone is asking me a question, they're giving me all sorts of clues. And am I taking the time to process what those clues are in order to come up with an answer that is useful to that person and is thoughtful on my part?
Absolutely. I think listening is so important because a lot of information is lost because we're not listening enough. Across those many years of quizzing, I learned to listen to what the quizmaster was saying. What are the clues he wanted to give us? What are the clues that he didn't want to give us but was accidentally doing so? And after about a decade of doing that, I think I'd become a reasonably good listener and could process, pick up information and process information better than I would have if I hadn't had that background.
So something else you said that caught my attention is I've been thinking a lot about this because I've been speaking to a lot of college-age students and they're thinking about getting their first job, you know, this grand disruption that they're about to do when they graduate from university and go out into the workforce. And you said something that was really powerful, which you would call people and ask for a minute of their time. And oftentimes this would turn into a conversation that was fairly lengthy. Could you talk us through your protocol or how you prepared for those calls so that people said, well, yeah, I've got a few seconds, you know, being potentially caught by surprise, but then they were willing to stay on the phone with you. They were willing to continue that conversation. So what are some things that you did to prepare so that once you got them, they were willing to stay engaged with you?
Firstly, I made sure that I knew what I wanted. The worst thing that you can do if you're calling a stranger is if you don't know what you want and then you ramble on during the call about what you want. So I made sure I knew exactly what I was looking for. Was I looking for a quick answer, a yes or no? Was I looking for a recommendation? Was I looking for a deep analysis of something? And I prepared so that I was absolutely clear in my mind what I wanted. The second thing that I did is I tried to find as much information as I could about the person that I was calling. If somebody had recommended me to them, then I made sure that I told them that. If I found them myself by looking around our corporate intranet, then I told them, hey, I was looking for information about this product or this topic, and your name came up so often that I thought I might ask you a question. And the third, I think, I don't think this is preparation, but I always made sure that I had something else to talk to them about. So I remember having a conversation with a colleague from Czechoslovakia, and we talked about Franz Kafka. And I was once talking to a colleague from Ireland, and we talked about James Joyce. And I remember both these colleagues being absolutely fascinated that here was this guy from Bangalore in India calling them about a question. And at the same time, the conversation was fun because they could also talk about something that mattered to them.
Mm. So good. All right. So Sumit, tell us what you do today. So where do you work and what do you do? Just so that people have a clearer sense of what your day job looks like.
Right. So I work for SAP, the world's largest provider of enterprise application software, and I'm a development manager at SAP. I'm part of an organization called Intelligent Enterprise Solutions. And what my team and I do is we build software. We have the unique opportunity to apply our creative talents to solve problems. And we work on a wide range of topics and technologies. And one of the recent topics that I've been involved with is conversational intelligence, which is a rather fancy way of saying chatbots, but I'll stick, I'll stick to saying conversational intelligence. And this is one of my pet topics at the moment. This is something that my team and I are really enjoying getting deep into. We are obsessed with building a conversational assistant which has personality. That's one of the current things that I'm doing. Having said that, there are many different things that I like to volunteer for. So I've currently volunteered, apart from my day job at work, I've volunteered for an initiative on how to ensure social learning at work. We don't claim to have solved the problem of social learning, but we are hard at work on that. And parallelly, I'm also working on another initiative on how trust in the workplace can be developed, nurtured, and scaled. So these are two of those side diversions. And again, the reason I feel comfortable taking on such additional projects or stretch assignments is because of all those years of reading and quizzing.
Among your many projects, one very important one that you did not mention is that you run a book club at SAP that you've run for over a decade. It's called Literati India. That's actually where you and I first met. Can you tell us why you started this and one of the authors potentially that's been very influential for you?
The story of Literati begins in 2009, I think the summer of 2009. I'd been with my company SAP for 4.5 years, or nearly 5 years at that time. And I realized that after my entry into the corporate world, my reading had come down in a big way. I just didn't have enough time. And I thought one very important part of my life, which was this connection to books, was slowly being lost. One of the ways to deal with that was to engage once again in a regular way with the world of books. And that's how Literati was born. And the format of Literati was unconsciously modeled on this TV show called Inside the Actor's Studio by James Lipton. So essentially what James Lipton would do is he would interview a famous actor, let's say Meryl Streep or Pierce Brosnan, on stage. And in the audience would be 500 students of acting. And I thought that was fantastic. And I wanted to do something similar for the world of literature. So the idea was to invite authors to come and speak at the book club. And I would have the opportunity to interview them on stage, and hopefully there would be an audience who would like to eavesdrop on our conversation. That was the format. We started that in 2009. After over a decade, it's still going strong. My special speaker at the 10th anniversary was 5-time world chess champion Vishwanathan Anand, an absolute legend in the world of Indian sports, and one of my childhood heroes. So I got to meet one of my childhood heroes after running this book club for 10 years, one of the greatest moments of my life.
So Sumeet, like I said, when we first met, I was speaking at your Literati India, and we were talking about the book Build an A-Team, and you have since told me that you have applied some of the ideas in that book around the S-curve of learning with your team, and I would love for you to share with us one of those stories.
Sure. Firstly, Build an A-Team is one of my favorite books, and I've learned a lot from it. I thought I knew exactly how to hire and grow a team, and I probably have unconsciously patted myself on the back for thinking that I was doing that until I read the book, and then I realized how much I had to learn. So to answer your question, this takes me back to the time when I first got the role of a manager. And as a manager, I inherited a team. So I didn't get the chance to build my own team. I got a team and I was told, here's a team that you can run. So I went over to my manager and I said, hey, I'm really struggling with this team. I'm not sure I have the right set of people. And his answer was, you're the one who wanted to get into management. This is your leadership challenge. It was not an answer that pleased me very much at that point.
No.
So I went back to my team, and one of the things that we needed to do in about 8 weeks is to make an important presentation to a member of our senior management team. And my team was just not ready for that. the team had not been trained on how to present their ideas, how to structure their thoughts, and we really struggled for a while. So I asked the team to start to do some dry runs. So we pretend that our member of senior management was already there, and we did the first dry run. I don't remember the details, but it didn't go very well. And the second one was better than the first. And through each step of the process, I tried to coach the team and help them, motivate them. There were people who were at different levels of the S-curve in terms of presenting. And it took a while. And I think after the sixth dry run, we were good to go. And the team was quite annoyed with me then. And when I had my one-on-one with my manager a week later, he said, "I want to let you know that your team thinks you do too many dry runs." And I remember telling him, "I know what I'm doing. Just back me through this phase and you'll see what we're trying to do." So long story short, a couple of weeks later, we have a presentation with this member of our senior management team. And he says, before he leaves the room, "That was one of the best presentations I sat through all year. Well done. You have a great team and you have this knack for doing presentations, dear team." And I think that's when I gained back the affection and the trust of my team members, because they knew that all that toil had not been for nothing. And the interesting thing is, I had a year-end performance feedback conversation with my manager where he said, "You know, the team said the great thing about Sumit is he got us to do six dry runs." So I couldn't help suppress a small smile.
So you had people who were at the top of their S-curve, maybe didn't want to be on the S-curve with you anyway. And you said, "You know what? We're going to give you a challenge. We're going to push you, give you the opportunity to move into the sweet spot or to keep climbing." They pushed, or they complained vociferously. And yet at the end of the year, it was one of the highlights.
Absolutely. I think that as technologists, as engineers, sometimes we may not realize how important it is to structure our thoughts and present them in a way that makes an impact on someone else. And that was a big learning for that team. They were all very good at what they were doing. They were very good at programming. They were very good at solving problems. And I was very happy that as their coach, in my role as their manager and coach, that I was able to shine a light on one area of their practice, of their work, that needed their attention.
You like to share quotes on Twitter, and you also share beautiful images. So anybody who wants to follow you, if you can maybe share your Twitter handle, and we'll include it in the show notes. But can you share a quote that's meaningful for you, and perhaps also meaningful within the context of the conversation that we're having today?
One of my favorite quotes comes from this book called Imagine It Forward by Beth Comstock. And I had the great honor and pleasure of interviewing her at Literati some years ago. And the quote goes, "You don't just work submissively for a company you tolerate. You agitate, sometimes rebelliously, to craft it into something great." Unquote. And the reason I like this quote so much is that in a very short way, it explains or it illustrates my philosophy for working in any organization that I'm part of, any team that I am part of. There's a saying which goes, don't ask for permission, ask for forgiveness. And this is something, this spirit is something that I've tried to bring into my work in every organization that I've worked for. And this is also the spirit that I try to bring into the work that my team and I do.
All right. So Sumit, for people who are listening and they're thinking, wow, he's so interesting, because you are, and they want to engage with you further, what's a good way to do that? Where can they find you?
I can be reached on Twitter or LinkedIn. So on Twitter, I'm at iSumitShetty. So I as in iPod or iPad. And on LinkedIn, I'm at linkedin.com/in/iSumitShetty.
Perfect. Okay. And then for everybody who's listening, we'll also include that in the show notes. Our entire conversation has been about books, about how they've loomed large in this really wonderful way in your life. So could you make a few book recommendations for us?
I'm going to go with a mixture of fiction and nonfiction recommendations. And let me start off with Ogilvy on Advertising by David Ogilvy. This is one of those books that has had a huge influence on the way that I think and that I write, especially when I communicate. And I think for every person who's interested in advertising and communication, I strongly recommend Ogilvy on Advertising. What would be a good fiction recommendation? I think I'm going to go with the great Dashiell Hammett and his book, The Maltese Falcon, which was turned into a great movie. So watch the movie and read the book, preferably read the book first. And I'm going to go with the third recommendation. I think I'll go with Beth Comstock's Imagine It Forward. It's one of those books in the last 5 years that's had a huge influence on me.
Great. So now, everyone who's listening, you have yet more books to read, which is super exciting, and from someone who's incredibly well-read. So what has been useful for you in this conversation, Sumeet?
So Whitney, we are living in a very difficult moment in world history where we're in the midst of a pandemic. And speaking with you today and retraversing the arc of my life just reminded me about how many things I have in my life to be grateful for. From that summer present to go and visit Sunny's Circulating Library to participating in the first quiz bowl of my life and winning it, having so many incredible experiences through the book club, meeting so many different people, including you. And I think you've been a lucky charm of sorts for the book club, because I've only had amazing speakers after you spoke at the book club. So I think it reminds me of the fact that I've been incredibly lucky in my life, and I'm very grateful for all the opportunities that I've had in my life and for all the wonderful people who showed up at the right moments.
You know, Sumeet, I love that idea of things being very difficult and challenging and taking that moment you said of just gratitude and how it always shifts things just a little bit, doesn't it? So Sumeet, any final thoughts that you'd like to share with us as we wrap up?
You know, as I was thinking about this conversation and the effect that books have had on my life, I think that books have positively disrupted my life, and especially the ideas in those books. There's the saying that once an idea enters your mind and it expands your mind never goes back to its original dimensions. So I think the single biggest disruption in my life has been that visit to the local library and the series of effects that it has had throughout my life. So that's my personal disruption moment.
Sumeet Shetty, oh, what a joy this hour has been with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Whitney. Such a pleasure to be in conversation with you. And thank you for being such a gracious moderator and asking me such lovely questions.
So much to take away here, but I'll do just five. Number one, it is interesting to me that in Sumeet's software development work, it's all around chatbots, around conversational intelligence, and that you can decipher an answer in a question. He certainly, as you saw, as you heard, models that intelligence in his real-life conversations. That had me then thinking back to an episode we did a couple of years ago with Lisa K. Solomon, episode 82, where she talked about designing a conversation. She says that conversations are interactive. They have connectivity. They often start with generative questions, but we're never really taught how to have those conversations. Second, I really appreciated Sumeet's focus on the practice of gratitude. If you haven't already, I would encourage you to go back and listen to episode 160 of our podcast around battling entitlement. Gratitude is the antidote to entitlement, that idea of what do I have enough of? What am I grateful for? Three, Sumeet was mesmerized by Beth Comstock, former vice chair of GE, and he should be. Since you can't hear his interview with her, you can listen to ours, episode 77. We'll put a link in the show notes. Four, I really appreciated how Sumeet gave us that example of what do you do when you have people at the top of the S curve? It's a question people continually ask me. How do I manage people? They're bored. I want them to re-engage. Well, you do it by giving them a challenge where they say, all right, I'm out of here. I don't want to do that challenge. Or they're super energized and that pushes them back down into the sweet spot of the S curve. We talk about it in Build an A Team, not that example per se, but what to do with people at the top of the S curve. This is a nice practical example that you can apply some permutation of that in the work that you're doing today. Fifth, and finally, what you did not hear or observe, so I will tell you, is how carefully we crafted, at the behest of Sumeet, this interview. I sent him some initial questions, but then for the interview, we would do one question, see what answers came up, and then allow that answer to help us figure out what the next question would be. It was like this software sprint and a beautiful example of accelerant number 7 in the framework of personal disruption, where you're driven by discovery. You take a step forward, you gather feedback, and adapt. If you'd like to give us some feedback, some things that we can improve, please send me an email at wj@whitneyjohnson.com. If you'd like to be more public, if it's good, leave us a review wherever you listen to podcasts. Tell us what you enjoyed about the interview, and in advance, thank you. If you also like some book or podcast recommendations of mine to go along with Sumeet's as you climb your current S curve, go to whitneyjohnson.com/calm, C-A-L-M, as in stay calm amidst the chaos. There are podcasts, there are book recommendations for each of those 7 accelerants of personal disruption. Thank you again to Sumeet Shetty for being our guest. Thank you to you for listening. Thank you to my team, Emily Cottrell, Whitney Jobe, Melissa Ruddy, and Nancy Wilson. I'm Whitney Johnson, and this is Disrupt Yourself.